And good morning, and thank you all for swarming here this morning with the management leadership of the Obama team. We're going to spend this morning going over a set of agenda items, the strategies that Jeff Zients has articulated. All of you had a preview of them. If you hadn't seen them earlier, if you go through your ERMCO bag, there's a CD, in fact, with a reprint of the speech that Jeff gave back in February to the Center for American Progress. And Jeff spelled out six strategies that his team is undertaking to change government the way the president has in mind. And those six strategies are to eliminate waste, to drive top priorities, to leverage purchasing scale, close the IT performance gap, open government to results, and attract and motivate top talent. Now, we've got this morning for you as a real treat the leadership team that's working from OMB to drive this set of strategies. And we're going to go through and hear from them what's top of mind in terms of priorities. And I'll ask a few other questions if time permits, and then we'll have time for you to weigh in as well. Now, the top item on the list is eliminating waste, and I think the person who can start us off in that discussion, and let me introduce everybody, I'm sorry. On my immediate left is Danny Werfel. He's controller of the Office of Federal Financial Management. Next is Dr. Shelley Metzenbaum, who is Associate Director for Performance and Personnel Management. Further down is Dan Gordon, the Administrator of the Office of Federal Procurement Policy. And at the end of the line, Vivek Kundra, who is the Administrator of E-Government and Technology. What we'll do is start with Danny. And Danny, tell us what your top two to three priorities are at this point.
Thank you, Jonathan. Well, first let me comment that I think all of our priorities bleed into the various strategies that Jonathan mentioned. The other just overarching theme that I'd like to offer that I think will be echoed through each of our remarks, but certainly through mine, is that our approach here is to move towards transformational change, long-term change, but also to make sure that while we're doing it, that we are hitting critical success milestones in the short term as well that can act as building blocks towards that transformational change. In my area, I'll focus very quickly on three major priorities. Within eliminating waste, it's the eliminating improper payments. In each of my areas, by the way, these things are going to mostly sound familiar, but the key as being long-standing challenges in financial management, but the key is changing the approach that we take to each of these long-standing challenges. So first, in the area of improper payments, again, this is something we've been tackling for a while, but the president issued an executive order in November that outlined a set of strategies and deliverables that really gather from all that we've learned over time into tackling improper payments and pulls out what we believe to be the most promising strategies. More senior accountability in charging each agency to come up with a senior accountable official for improper payments. More frequent and targeted error measurements so we have a better understanding of what the root causes of error and we're zeroing in and doing it potentially more frequently than annually, as is the traditional way. Looking to build incentives both for state and local governments and for contractors to do a better job in terms of how they're spending the government dollars. So this is an area where we're setting bold targets, and we have a lot of interest right from the top. The president recently held an event in early March in Missouri. The main topic of that discussion was improper payments and how we can do a better job. Within eliminating waste, we also continue to go after real property. This is property that the government owns that we no longer need to, or improving the management of the property that we do need. So we expect in the near future to have a major policy announcement with respect to how we're going to tackle real property. And the other area I want to mention is financial systems. This is not only an eliminating waste category, but it's also another key part of the strategies, which is closing the technology gap in the government. In particular, in the area of financial systems and in systems generally, we do not always modernize our systems on cost and on schedule, and when we do modernize, we don't always get the optimal deployment that we're looking for. In the area of financial systems, this problem has become acute in recent years. In particular, financial systems and the cost to modernize them is going up. It's taking longer, sometimes 5 years, 7 years, 10 years, sometimes $400, $500, $800 million, and sometimes even more. And then once we are deployed in a modern financial system, we're finding that it's not always meeting our business needs. One of our major priorities is to turn that around, to start finding new and more efficient and better ways to modernize financial systems. And I look forward to working in that area and answer more questions about that. Final area of priority in my terrain is open government, and in particular, the responsibility we have in the government to make sure that the information that we're pushing into the public sphere is of high quality, reliability, it's comprehensive, and it's timely. And as the administration sat down to figure out where in government we want to vest the responsibility for improving the reliability of information, look no further than the CFOs of government, who have a long-standing practice and history and experience in building quality control frameworks around critical financial and other data, and making sure that that data is reliable before it hits the public sphere. So the CFO community, led by OMB, is taking on new measures to improve the reliability of information that's pushed into the public sphere, in particular information on USAspending.gov and Recovery.gov. Those are the top priorities in financial management.
Sounds pretty good. Shelley, you're involved in driving top priorities and focusing on performance, particularly since you all are working for the Chief Performance Officer. What are your top two or three priorities?
Thanks, Jonathan. So I want to talk a little bit about our efforts to deliver more value for the taxpayer dollar. And it is tempting to look at Jeff Zients' speech as our Chief Performance Officer and look at the columns under his speech and say, okay, we each have one of those stovepipes. But in fact, we're trying to be very outcome-focused. So eliminating waste includes the improper payments, but it's also finding ineffective programs so that you can make them more effective. It is driving top priorities. It's eliminating that waste so you can drive top priorities to get more value. Well, what is that more value? And I think the answer to that is very much being defined by the agency. So I'll come back to that in a second. But I think in all of these areas, whether or not it's leveraging scale or it's closing the IT gap, it's opening up government, or it's reconnecting people to their purpose in government, we're all working on all of that. But then we've picked specific actions we're taking to try and deliver on that. So what are the specific actions that we're focusing on to drive top priorities, and what do we mean by that? Because, you know, you can always say you're doing that. But I want to focus on that right now. I'm not going to talk about reconnecting people to their purpose, because John Barry's talking tomorrow morning, and he'll give you a great vision for how we're trying to do that. But in driving top priorities, this really is about getting government to, and I'll tell you the three strategies we've got. One is using performance information to lead, to learn, and to improve, in order to improve outcomes. The second is communicating that performance information coherently and concisely to improve results and transparency. And the third is to strengthen problem-solving networks. Those are big, phrases, but in fact, every word in those phrases makes a difference, and you are a very big part of making that happen. Let me focus first on the use performance information to lead, learn, and improve outcomes. We asked every cabinet member to identify between 3 and 8 high priority performance goals, which are in the president's fiscal year 2011 budget. How many of you know that, what they are? Okay, look around. It's not a very big number. What did I just do? I just got some feedback that's very important to us that says, okay, these are not trickling down across the organization. And in order to actually use performance goals to lead, people across the organization need to know what those goals are if they're affected by it. And given that all of you are working on all these mission support jobs, my guess is you should know what your goals are. They are in the Analytic Perspectives, Chapter 7, but hopefully you will have your agency heads start to talk about them. They are goals like moving 200,000 teachers, top quality teachers to low poverty areas. They are goals like increasing the renewable energy supply with specific numbers, specific quantities and dates. So we're trying to use goals to lead and to recognize that a specific target is a very convenient shorthand for communicating priorities across organizations to get people involved in delivering on it, but also using the measurement to learn. So Danny has talked about his priorities, and then he started talking about root cause analysis, looking at the data to figure out what the causes of problems are, but also what the causes of success are. So we are, around those high priority goals, beginning to have action plan meetings with agencies to make sure they're thinking about how are we going to deliver. If we want to start here and go here, what's the trajectory to get us there, and how are we going to know along the way if we're on or off track? We need the data to tell us that. It's not just, it's a whole suite of measures, not just one simple measure. And we need people to be analyzing the data and then digging down into the root causes, both the positive and negative ones, and then using that information to improve outcomes and then communicating it coherently and concisely. So we're building a federal performance website that will try to do that, not just for the public, incredibly important, not just for Congress, but also so people across government can see what each other's doing, so it'll be sortable by theme so that we can get out of our stovepipes and start focusing on problems that make a difference to the people on the ground. So we have a line of sight between what we're doing and what we're trying to accomplish. And finally, the strengthening problem-solving networks is that we cannot accomplish anything on our own in the federal government. We depend on others to do that, whether that's contractors, other levels of government, nonprofit grantees, etc. We also depend on people whom we don't directly fund, and we need to leverage them. We need to enlist them to help us. And so how do we do that? And trying to use communication to do that, trying to understand how you use incentives to do that. That's what we're trying to accomplish. We are really trying to move this from being a compliance-oriented exercise in order to comply with the obligations of the Government Performance and Results Act to a performance-improving exercise. And that's not an exercise, but a way of doing business.
Shelley, let me just push you a little bit on this business of what it's not. Can you contrast what you're doing to what was going on, say, 5 years ago? Or, you know, what's the accountability mechanism? How are you going to make this really happen?
Great question, Jonathan. Thank you. So there have been accountability mechanisms in the past and what we were doing in the past. So all of you know what you were doing in the past, which was you had red, yellow, green scorecards, and you also had PART reviews, the performance assessment rating tools, program by program. And you got rated by folks in OMB. And quite honestly, that was a useful system for increasing the production of goals and measurement. We have moved from where we were 15 years ago to where we are today in terms of thinking about how do we manage for results, how do we use goals and measures to manage with. But also, quite honestly, we had a lot of problems with that system in that people were producing this data just to put in reports that nobody read. Really, in some cases, somebody may have read them, but a lot of these reports were just, they go over, at a lot of these plans, they go over and they get delivered and then nobody looks at them. So what we are really trying to do here is to move this from a compliance-focused effort to something where everybody goes, wow, this really changes the way I'm doing business. And they do, because they're looking at the data. As I will say, I would quote some people from an action plan meeting in one of the agencies. It was like, wow, this is really connecting the dots. We really are beginning to work across the organization to focus on what we've always wanted to focus on but never could do that. We are trying to get the expectations aligned with the way we want to do business in the agencies, connecting people with their purpose. And the accountability mechanism is twofold. One is that, or I'll say it's three pieces of it. One is transparency, by getting some of this information out to the public, we hope that it will encourage more agencies to pay attention. But we know, and we know from the evidence, and this is about evidence-based management, we know from the evidence that disclosure alone doesn't always motivate the changes you want to have happen. So we're also having meetings on a regular basis. Vivek will tell you a little bit more about his meetings that he's having in the tech area. But we started with action plan meetings around the high priority goals to make sure that, and we asked, and Danny talked about identifying senior officials. We've asked for goal leaders to be identified, very clearly identified. But then they need to come in and talk about how you're going to get this accomplished. And if it doesn't make sense, we'll continue to talk to you. So OMB will be talking with you. So OMB is still in the picture very much as an accountability assuring mechanism. And then we expect quarterly performance updates, and we will do quarterly reviews to see if things are off track. And if they're off track, if you have a cogent strategy for getting them back on track, if you know they're off track. Finally, in addition, we are asking each agency head to start their own internal constructive performance reviews. Treasury's already begun them by Bureau. Some bureaus, like the FDA, have started FDA track. So we're trying to create this culture of performance management that's results-focused, performance-improving. And then finally, I would say we still are OMB, and so I don't think I need to say more than that, except that, you know, if you're really not paying attention, you don't get in trouble if you don't meet your target. That's not the problem. The problem is if you don't know why you didn't meet your target and you don't have a plan to deal with it. And if you don't, we're going to be asking some very hard questions come budget time.
Dan, you're the newest member of this team, but certainly not new to acquisition in the world of contracting. You've been busy lately. why don't you give us your top two or three priorities as well?
Thanks, Jonathan. I will. Although these chairs, I have to tell you, are a little bit too comfortable. I feel like sitting there. You're going to hear that all of our worlds overlap. There's a lot of collaboration among the four of us. But let me talk a little bit about procurement. I'm going to try to be very brief. My suggestion for the next ERMCO would be to give us more time. I would love a session where I got to hear from many of you, both at the agencies and the vendors, beyond this limited time. Let me be very brief. We start with the facts. Where were we? What's been going on in the federal procurement space over the past 8 years? The spend has more than doubled. Many people in this room remember when we talk about the federal procurement spend being on the order of $150 billion a year, $200 billion. Now it's over $500 billion a year, fact one. Fact two, the acquisition workforce, its numbers have not kept pace and nowhere near kept pace. They've essentially been stable over the past few years with some uptick more recently. That's fact two. Fact three, the prior administration was so focused on outsourcing that in many situations, our sense, and that's a very collective our sense has been that we've lost control of what's going on, what's going to contractors, what needs to be done by federal employees. That's the basis. That's the background for what we've been doing in OFPP. Our three priorities flow from the facts. Right? Priority number one, we have got to strengthen the acquisition workforce. So the president's budget, for example, includes $158 million to build up the civilian agency's acquisition workforce. That's both hiring and training. Priority number two, we have got to get off of this unsustainable path of increased spending on procurement. We cannot continue with the procurement spend each year going up 10 to 12%. Unsustainable. We have to save money. We have to reduce the risk to the federal government. So fiscal responsibility is our second priority. Third priority, we need to rebalance our relationship with contractors. That doesn't mean contractor bashing. It doesn't mean working without contractors. There are many contractors in this room. There are many contractors across the government agencies doing incredibly important work. But we need to be sure that we're not contracting out things that we, the federal employees, need to be doing, that where we do contract out, that we maintain control of our mission. We have to maintain control of our operations. That's in very much in brief, our top three priorities that we're working on.
On I think it was March 31st, you issued a Federal Register notice about work reserved for federal employees, or what used to be called inherently governmental. What are the implications for that? What's that going to mean across government?
Jonathan, what we issued on the 31st was a draft policy letter from our office, the Office of Federal Procurement Policy. So it's a draft OFPP policy letter. It's out for public comment for 60 days. We expect a lot of comment from industry, from agencies, from the Hill, from trade unions. Let me tell you where we want to be at the end of this process when we finalize this policy letter later this year. We want there to be clearer guidance so that, as the President said, we no longer have a blurred line between work that can be contracted out and work that has to be done by federal employees. We want to understand when work is contracted out, if it's closely associated with inherently governmental. At the end of the day, we want people to understand what we need to do to prevent a contractor unwittingly sliding into inherently governmental work. Or if we're talking about a critical function, which could be acquisition, could be IT, could be mission critical, we want to be sure that the federal government maintains control of its mission and its operations. Using contractors for that work is fine, as long as we maintain control of our mission and our operations. At the end of the day, if our guidance, once it's finalized, is clear and helpful, we will have succeeded. That's our goal.
Vivek, Jeff Zients has said that he believes IT represents the largest gap between the private and public sectors. So tell us your top two or three priorities in terms of closing that gap and changing things the way the President has in mind.
Sure. So there are a couple of main areas that we're focused on, and the President has been very, very clear from day one that he wants to make sure that every dollar we spend on information technology actually helps serve the American people. So for far too long, what's happened is we've spent billions of dollars on information technology, yet we haven't seen the dividends produced that were promised up front. So there are four areas that we're focused on. The first one is to effectively manage a multi-billion-dollar IT portfolio. Second area is around making sure that the investments we're making, we're doing so in a very efficient and effective way. Third is a focus on open government, and fourth is around cybersecurity. In the first area, what we did last year was that we launched the IT dashboard, which was focused on shining light on the health of IT investments across the federal government. This year, what we're doing is we're taking that information and we're acting on it through TechStat sessions, where we bring in senior officials who are running these IT projects from a technology perspective, but also the business owners. And we're already beginning to see an impact of these TechStat sessions. One example is at the SBA. The SBA was spending enormous amounts of money on their HSPD 12 implementation, yet they realized they could do it with this TechStat session at a fraction of the cost if they just leveraged the GSA model in terms of implementation. And so they've decided to move towards GSA. It's going to save money, and they're going to move forward much faster than they normally would have. Danny and I have been working closely on financial management systems. As Danny outlined, the challenges around large-scale IT projects specifically in financial management. Second area is around looking at efficiency and effectiveness, especially around infrastructure. So that tends to be one of the largest areas of spend in the federal government. $19 billion last year, it continues to rise. What we did last year is we focused heavily in a cohesive strategy around moving towards the cloud, around the consolidation of data centers across the federal government. This year, we're executing against that path. We've already seen, for example, NASA step back from a $1.5 billion investment in data centers, and they're rethinking that investment in the context of cloud computing. We've already seen how GSA has risen to the occasion, as Martha mentioned yesterday, in terms of moving GSA to an entity that actually provide services that support agencies. What they did as a function of the open government cloud computing and providing a platform that allowed agencies to leverage a public engagement platform rather than each agency spending millions of dollars or hundreds of thousands of dollars, huge savings, greater efficiencies, a better outcome. Third area around open government, on his first full day in office, the president issued a memorandum on transparency and open government. Since then, we've seen whether it's the launch of data.gov as a key administration initiative to what we've been able to do in terms of unleashing the power of dashboards, whether that's in the space of technology, regulations, healthcare, to where we've hardwired this culture this year through the Open Government Directive and agencies that have issued specific plans in terms of realizing the president's vision of an open, transparent, and participatory government. Fourth area we're focused on is cybersecurity. The president, in the very early on in the administration, issued a bottom-up review of cybersecurity across the board. And through that process, we issued a cyber policy review where we highlighted issues around national security, issues around our security posture within the federal government. Since then, Howard and I have been working very, very closely together to make sure that we're making investments in cybersecurity, as Shelley mentioned, that don't focus necessarily on compliance, but real outcomes. It's a huge shift this year in terms of what we're doing as far as FISMA is concerned. Huge shift in terms of greater transparency, for example, with CNCI and how the U.S. government is spending money on cybersecurity. That's going to be critical in terms of making sure that the investments we make across the board to serve the American people are done so in a context where we realize that cybersecurity threats are real, they're here today, and we need to take them head on. But across the board, all of us work very closely together when it comes to pulling our buying power in IT around the efficiency bucket, making sure that we're leveraging enterprise contracts so we're not diluting the government's buying power, or whether it's performance, making sure that from an IT perspective that we're really driving performance across the board. And with Danny, as we talked about, whether it's improper payments or other areas, working closely to realize that technology can play a vital role in terms of realizing these objectives.
Let me ask you a question about the eGov fund. Congress provided, I think, $35 million to OMB for the eGov fund, which I think turns out to be about, well, it's more than OMB received in the last 7 years combined. What are your plans for that fund? What are you going to do to make use of all that?
Sure. So there are actually some really exciting plans. One area is an area that Danny and I are working on very, very closely, which is the launch of a payment portal, a cloud-based payment portal. So if you look at some of the challenges we face today around tracking funding, part of it is because there's so many areas where funding is dispersed, rather than having one platform where we could track every single dollar that leaves the U.S. government. Second area we're investing in is collaboration technologies for the federal workforce. FedSpace is a model we're looking at to figure out how we can use collaboration technologies. As you know, in the middle of Snowmageddon, one of the key things that allowed us to work together was teleworking. What we're trying to do is invest capital in making sure that across the board that we double down on tools that are going to increase our productivity, but also move us in an environment where 1.8 plus million employees can leverage these technologies. Third area, and I could go on and on about where we're making investments, whether it's on data.gov or USD spending, is investing in technologies that are going to move the government forward, and also the work we're doing on challenges and prizes, standing up a platform that's going to enable innovation to happen across the federal government.
Well, it's clear that what you've described, all four of you, is a interconnected and sort of mutually supporting set of initiatives. How are you doing it? I mean, is Monday morning a meeting with Jeff Zients? How do you guys play together and actually pull this off? I mean, is there kind of an inside story you can give us as to how you actually make this all work, Danny?
Well, I think for the first thing I'd say is that the priorities themselves are not, we try to design them not to be in a stovepipe, even though you've asked each of them. So Vivek and I, for example, when I say it's a priority in the financial management community to end the practice of overly expensive and sub-optimized financial system deployments, it's really a shared objective of Vivek and I, and we have, more than once a week, maybe sometimes three or four or five times a week, we're sitting down together with an integrated OFFM eGov team going through exactly what the right strategy is, the sequencing, who do we need to call, who do we need to get championed, who do we need to get buy-in. And then when Vivek, who's established what I believe to be these very effective tech stat environments, where you have these focused sessions with the accountable officials coming in and answering some tough questions about their projects, when it's a financial system project, Vivek and I are co-chairing that meeting together, and both reaching out in different ways, me to the CFO, Vivek to the CIO, and then even with cross collaboration there as well. So it's, I don't know if there's a grand design here of a playbook, but by defining the priorities to overlap, and because we define the priorities not based on a traditional stovepipe, but after the exact problem we're trying to solve, it creates that overlap. And then it's just about, under Jeff's leadership, fostering a collaborative work environment. Jeff's done a good job of that, and we all feed off each other very well.
Dan, you got it?
And similarly, I would just say that we talk together all the time. We meet with Jeff formally in the course of the week every week. But in addition, we're all meeting. So whether it's my team working with Danny's team about a contract that involves a financial management system, or us working with Vivek's team in terms of an IT contract, when we talk about rebalancing the relationship with contractors, one of the things that means is we've got to be in charge of the contract. So if the contract's gone bad, we need to consider options that we can take. And that's another example of an area where we collaborate very closely.
Yeah. I guess the lesson, I'm not sure, the lesson I would suggest that our work has, perhaps for the work that we're all asking of you, is what we're trying to do is doing problem-focused, problem-solving collaboration, where these are, as Danny was saying, really goal-focused. We know what the problems are that we're focusing on, and they're data-informed discussions. And we're bringing the people into the room. We're trying as hard as we can to bring the people into the room who need to be part of those discussions. But it turns out to be a phenomenally effective way to get business done that's been done at the state level, the local level, and at the federal level. But I think the first place you got to start is saying, okay, what is the problem or what is the we're trying to solve or the opportunity we're trying to pursue? And then let's get the folks in the room who need to be there, and let's just drill down till we figure out what the options are. We go try things. We see if they work. If they don't work, we come back and do a mid-course correction, try again. And I think that's the approach we've been taking in the way we're doing our business, and we hope that you'll be taking too.
Terrific. Well, we've got all four of these folks together here. I think it's time to turn the tables a little bit and see if there are questions from you in the audience. Nobody? There we go, back in the corner.
Good morning. I just wanted a little bit of clarity. When we talked about compliance and moving more toward outcomes, my interpretation is still within the bounds of this compliant environment that we live in, still focus more on the outcomes. And I guess I just wanted clarity. Are we really getting away from compliance? Because I think that's really, in some part, that's the business that we're in. But what I'm hearing is focus more on the outcomes, still living within a lot of the compliance activities that we have to perform.
Who wants to try that one?
I'll go for it.
Yeah, I think that it is a challenge to make the transition from a compliance-oriented culture to an outcome-focused culture. And the first thing I think you have to start with is the question, what are we doing now and why? And really ask that why question. What are we trying to accomplish? And then say, okay, here's what we're trying to accomplish. Now, let's take a look at all these compliance obligations, whether it is laws, rules, or more often, most often, these practices that have built up over time that people think are the right things to do. Because we've done them in the past. They have involved less risk because we've done them in the past. And I think we just have to keep saying, okay, what am I trying to accomplish over here? And is the work I'm doing really going to get us there? And if there are barriers in the way that are rules or are laws, then we need to start conversations to get rid of those barriers. A lot of the time, they're really not. Those barriers don't exist. They're perceived. But they're not real barriers. And then you have to say, okay, how do we bring about change in that area? It is not easy. We oftentimes have guidance out there that we can then have audit folks come and look at and say you didn't stick with your guidance, but that guidance can oftentimes be inconsistent. So this isn't an easy change, but when you make that change, whether it is trying to educate kids or get the water cleaner or reduce costs, reduce improper payments. When you can get to that point, the job gets a whole lot more exciting. I've seen that transition happen. You know, so I'd say yes, we are definitely trying to get to outcomes, and we have to figure out when the compliance requirements made sense because they established boundaries of improper behavior, unethical or whatever. And when they don't make sense, and we need to figure out how to change them.
Let me give you an example of what compliance looks like. In the security space, for example, there's a process called the CNA process. And essentially, you're supposed to go through a certification and accreditation process at the very beginning of deploying a new system and then revisiting it every 3 years. So the State Department, in the last 6 years, spent $138 million generating these paper reports that were a function of compliance and filed them in these file cabinets that, frankly, were more secure than the very systems they were supposed to protect. So now that's a culture of compliance. And what ends up happening is you end up with a negative momentum that continues to build up. And so the State Department is not alone here. Agency after agency was continually focusing on creating these paper reports rather than protecting the very systems. When we realize that when you're confronting a cybersecurity threat, you can't really meet your challenger who is evolving on a daily basis and changing the attack vectors on a real-time basis with a report that's generated every 3 years or so. So a huge shift in policy in terms of what we're doing as a function of moving towards real-time monitoring, real-time security, whether it's the NIST guidance that's coming out or the FISMA 2010 reporting platform that we've built. So that's part of what we're trying to do, not just across cybersecurity, but across the board as we think about outcomes.
Danny?
I was just going to tie your question earlier to Shelley with this question in terms of, you asked Shelley, how are things different now than they were 5 years ago in terms of how we approach things? And when you asked that question, it reminded me of, let's just take financial systems for a second. I think traditionally, and this is not a bad thing, we need to continue to do this. Traditionally, the emphasis has been on making sure every agency has a coherent and a cohesive plan for how they procure technology. You're making sure that the right organizational alignment is in place, making sure the right policies are in place, and we spend a lot of time over the years making sure that each agency has those baseline tools in all areas, in human capital, in IT, in financial management. What we're saying now is you need to continue building that up, but you also have to attack the problem from the other end. In financial systems, it's not good enough that every agency is doing those exercises to put those plans and those processes in place. We also have to recognize exactly where we're failing or not meeting our objectives and go after that in a real targeted way. So that if you're an agency that is, overspending on a system or is 2 or 3 years behind a deployment, that there's greater accountability and focus. And it's not just that you have those baseline pieces in place, that those compliance pieces in place. If you're not hitting certain goals and objectives, we want to spend as much emphasis on that, if not more, than OMB monitoring whether every agency's put in these various compliance pieces, even though those various compliance pieces are important.
Let me just, I think Vivek and Danny, giving specific examples sometimes helps illustrate. So let me illustrate one thing that happened, that's happened in the past that we're trying to change in the future. In the last administration, in the performance assessment rating tool, every agency was asked to create efficiency measures. And the efficiency measures were clearly done to achieve a certain outcome. That outcome is think about lower cost ways to accomplish the same objective or the same cost ways to accomplish more. The problem is efficiency measures don't always make sense. And so every agency was in these huge negotiations with their OMB examiners about producing an efficiency measure so they were compliant with that expectation, with that obligation. One agency actually ended up with a National Academy of Sciences study on efficiency measures that they procured because the efficiency measures did not make any sense. So they had to spend money on why shouldn't we have to do efficiency measures, which clearly was inefficient because everybody could have told them they shouldn't have done efficiency measures. But there was a compliance, there was an obligation that had been established for a very good reason. There was an outcome to be improved, which was finding more productive ways to do business. But by creating an obligation that didn't make sense in every case, rather than having those data-driven discussions, those goal-focused data-driven discussions to figure out, okay, is there a lower cost way you can do this? First asking, are you accomplishing what you're trying to accomplish? And then, is there a lower cost way to do this? And what's the sensible way to figure that out? That's outcome-focused versus saying everybody's got to have efficiency measures.
Not seeing any more questions, or we have a couple?
There's
okay.
Seven.
Okay, great.
Collaboration. What I haven't heard a lot about from this new administration, have not heard as much about consolidation. The president's management agenda focused pretty heavily on centers of excellence and shared service centers in financial systems, for example, just being one of those. Is that still a focus in terms of IT and trying to come up with these centers of excellence that would manage larger IT systems and processes for the federal government?
Well, I think we have focused heavily on the consolidation front. That's our entire data center consolidation strategy is predicated on consolidation. And secondly, part of what we're trying to do as we look at areas, whether it's in payroll, where there's already been consolidation and we've seen efficiencies as a function of payroll, or the tech stat sessions that we're running, part of what we're trying to do is unearth and figure out where consolidation makes sense versus where it doesn't. It's not a blunt instrument where we just want to go around randomly consolidating, but we want to be much more surgical when it comes to consolidation, because what we've also seen is where there have been spectacular failures as a result of forced consolidation where it makes no business sense. So what ends up happening is you end up with these business cases that promise these dreamy scenarios where you'll end up saving billions of dollars and customers will be happy and everyone will be dancing on this green field, and you realize, you know, 1 year into the project, as Danny mentioned, it's way behind schedule, years, or way over budget in some cases. We saw what happened with Dimers, for example. 12 years, $1 billion later, everyone had to step back. And what we want to make sure is we're responsible and we're very methodical when it comes to consolidation. Where it does make sense, the administration is moving forward aggressively. Where it doesn't make sense, we have a very surgical approach in terms of figuring out how do we, at the end of the day, make sure that we're protecting the taxpayers' interest in terms of how we spend money.
Dan, you've got some examples?
Yeah, let me give you a couple of examples in terms of consolidation of the world of procurement. As we're looking to demonstrate fiscal responsibility and to save money in our procurement system, one of the challenges we see is that in our face to industry, the government often seems like dozens and dozens of medium-sized customers. instead of the very large customer, in fact, the world's largest customer, which is what we are. So one of the things we've looked at is the redundant blanket purchase agreements that are out there, where every agency is, and sometimes every component of an agency is negotiating its own BPA. We're looking at interagency contracts that are overlapping, that seem like consolidation may make sense for them. We're not consolidating automatically. We're not opposing interagency contracts automatically, even if there's overlap. There's sometimes benefit in having multiple ones. But nonetheless, we're looking for opportunities to consolidate our contracts so that they make more sense. One particularly nice example is one where GSA is taking the lead right now, and that's the RFQ out on the street for office supplies. That's, we're hoping, is going to end up with a BPA that will be open to all federal customers instead of being a one-agency BPA, so that we'll be able to buy office supplies government-wide with better prices and easier an easier process than we've had in the past.
Question over here in the center.
Hi, I'm Mike Carlton, the CIO at the Department of Health and Human Services. I'm interested in how much you think you'll be able to integrate the execution of these strategies across functions. And I would try to stitch these together by saying, if you look at the $19 billion of infrastructure, for the most part, it's already awarded to contractors. And my experience is those contractors, when it comes to risk issues like security, are not strongly incentivized to incur more costs than the result, you know, to reduce risk on the security side for us. Furthermore, my colleagues who are program managers are not enthusiastic about reopening a procurement process when it's already been completed and they have the option of exercising unilateral annual options because the procurement workforce isn't much available to radically, renegotiate the existing contracts. So I think it's easy to pick out some aspects of the current system that cause us to have the results we have. And it is an opportunity in terms of how you'll operationalize the strategy to say, how are we going to address that incumbent contractor dimension of the issue?
So I think a couple of ways. One is if you look at consolidation, for example, as we're talking about data center being one area, part of what we're doing right now, we've charged Richard Spires, who is the CIO of Department of Homeland Security, and Mike Duffy, who's a CIO at the Department of Treasury, to help us drive this initiative forward. Homeland Security, for example, they're taking very, very aggressive steps to go from 20-plus data centers to 2 in the next 3.5 years. And part of what they're doing is they're taking on the tough issues, whether it's on the contracting front, whether it's on change management in terms of a new world where you actually have 2 data centers and you don't need 20-plus data centers at DHS. And from a contracting perspective and these tech set sessions that we've designed, one of the things we've done is we've made sure that we collaborate across the board. So whether it's bringing the right people from an OMB perspective on the contracting side, the RMOs on the budgeting side, and at the agency level also, making sure that we've got the business owners and the technology owners. Because a lot of times what we're finding at these tech set sessions, unfortunately, sometimes this is the first place they're meeting at, the business side and the technology side, as we confront these really, really difficult issues. I don't think it's going to be easy, and your point is accurate in terms of the easy thing to do is to actually just go out there and renew another task order on a contract that may have been awarded, multi-year contract. But that's part of what we're trying to do is step back and realize that there's a new world, there's a new paradigm that we need to drive toward. And part of that new paradigm involves cloud computing, rethinking how we deliver these computing services. So it's not as easy as saying, hey, we're just going to go out there and consolidate our infrastructure and modify contracts that we may already have in place. But it's also rethinking how we deliver technology services across the board.
Dan, you had a...
I was just going to say, one of the roles that I think OFPP is playing with our colleagues here is pointing out that our federal procurement system provides way more flexibility than we sometimes think. Sometimes people say to me, oh, we can't talk to vendors because of the procurement rules. And I say, of course you can talk to vendors. You've got to do it in the right way, but of course you can talk to vendors. Or people will say, but we've got to keep moving forward with this contract because the contractor expects us to spend hundreds of millions of dollars. And my question will often be, what's the guaranteed minimum if it's an IDIQ contract? We don't have to keep moving. If there's a reason to pull back, we need to be willing to pull back. It's often not taking advantage of flexibilities that the procurement system gives us. I want to be sure that our colleagues across OMB and across the federal government appreciate how much flexibility the acquisition system gives us, including occasionally the fact that we have a Part 49 of the FAR, which gives the government the right to terminate a contract if termination is the right answer.
All right. Well, we're down to just a few more minutes. I'd like to ask each of our panelists to kind of think ahead 3-4 years towards the end of the first term of the Obama administration. And what can we expect? What would you hope to be the state of things in terms of what you're responsible for? What would be your proudest achievements, for example, that you could point to when the Obama administration concludes its first term? We'll start at the other end, I guess, with Vivek, and let you get the start of this one.
Okay. Sure. So in the first category, as I mentioned, around effectively managing the IT portfolio, we would be very, very focused on cutting waste, taking on IT projects that don't deliver value, either terminating them, halting them, or turning them around. And that will be a derivative from the tech set sessions that we drive. Around efficiency and effectiveness, actually making sure when we look at cloud computing, for example, 3 years from now, agencies aggressively moving towards the cloud and the industry would have addressed some of the security issues that we face. But more importantly, making sure that the investments we're making in technology are actually having an impact on the lives of the American people. For example, the student aid form, much easier to fill out. Your experience with the IRS, much easier and different than it is today. Your experience when it comes to veterans' benefits, much easier and streamlined in terms of how you interact with the VA. Third area, what the president has been driving, hardwiring this culture of a transparent and open government. The plans that agencies have laid out in terms of open government plans, you would see those come to life, not just plans, but actually delivering value around those plans themselves. And of course, the model of dashboards, really moving towards an environment where we're engaging the American people in addressing some of the toughest problems this country faces, making sure that we're creating an environment where 1.8 plus million people can collaborate using technology platforms. And of course, in the cybersecurity space, moving us away from a culture of compliance and recognizing that cybersecurity is not a destination, but it's a journey, that the path we're set on, moving much more towards a real-time enterprise where agencies are not going to be filing these multi-million dollar reports, but actually where we can see on a real-time basis the security posture of the federal government.
Dan, 3 years from now, what do you think?
Well, at IRMCO, what is this going to be, IRMCO 2012 or IRMCO 2013? Let me tell you, I spend a lot of my time going out to the agencies, listening to the acquisition workforce, talking to senior managers. I would hope that 2 or 3 years from now, when I go out there, let me give you a couple of basic things. When I say to people in the room in the acquisition workforce, how many of you have been working for the federal government for more than 15 years, most of the hands go up. When I say how many of you have been hired within the last 5 years, there are typically very few hands. I'd like that picture to be different. I want there to be a lot of people that say, I joined within the past few years, and I'd also like them to say, I've gotten good training, and I love working for the federal government. We've lived up to the promise of being the employer of choice. All right? I would like to hear from contractors that they understand the rules better, that they're getting more and better management coming out of the contracting officers and their contracting officers' technical representatives, that contractors feel like they're able to do their work, they're appreciated in the service they provide to the federal government with clear rules about what contractors can and cannot do.
Fabulous.
And one more thing.
Okay.
I'm sorry, one more thing, because I can't leave this out. 2 or 3 years from now, we will have seen that the contracting cost curve has bent. We have moved that curve down, so we have real savings in contracting.
So I hope when I come back 3 years from now and we all sit on this panel, you'll all know what your high priority goals are. at the agency level, but also within your own organization. And more than that, you'll be able to say, hey, we accomplished, I'll say 85% of them. I won't be unhappy if it's 70. And why don't I say 100% of them? Because we asked agency heads to set ambitious targets. So we know we can't meet all of them. I'd like to go for 90%, actually. And I hope that you know what those goals are, but also if you on the 10% that you didn't make, why you didn't make them and what you're trying to do and where you are planning to go in the next 18 to 24 months as you sit here. So I hope all of us really have a sense of what government is accomplishing and what we're trying to accomplish and a much better understanding of what the factors are that we have to influence in order to move those, to get that curve going in the right direction and accelerate improvement.
Danny, the final word's yours.
Final word's mine. Great. Very quickly, because I want to wrap with a kind of a thought for the audience, and that is, from my vantage point in financial systems, I want us to look back 3 years from now and say, we no longer do things the way we did. We no longer implement billion-dollar ERP system implementations that are bigger than our business requirements actually need. So I want to change, you talk about bending the curve, bend the curve on financial system deployments so they're more right-sized to our most critical needs. In improper payments, I think the one thing I really want to see is that we're leveraging technology through things like data sharing and forensic analysis and data mining to really get at the problem in a risk management way, and that there are exciting innovations that are now a thought in the future are now actively being utilized. And in open government, I want us to be able to converse with you on statistics on completeness and reliability and timeliness of information that's going out on usaspending.gov in a way that we don't just have the metrics in place, but we can show some improvement from where we are today in the baseline to where we'll be 3 years from now. Let me close by articulating back to your question about how we work together, because I have a vision for how we work together 3 years from now. And I think that one of the things that hasn't been mentioned yet today is that what you've heard a lot from us is a lot of the planning that has gone on over the last year to set up our goals and our strategies. But this administration, I believe, has already tackled one of the most challenging management challenges that the government has faced in many years, and that's the implementation of the Recovery Act. And in implementing the Recovery Act, which really dominated a lot of our time as a group over the first 8, 9, 10 months of the administration and continues to, we really worked as a matrixed organization. And I know in particular any of your folks that are on the front line of doing the Recovery Act, many of them have commented back to us and given the feedback that they've never seen OMB work so fluidly together in terms of the way we approach the challenge. It wasn't a financial management challenge, nor a procurement challenge, or an IT or performance, but it was an integrated challenge. And I'm really proud of the work that OMB has done with the federal agencies to be where we were on February 17th, the day the bill was enacted, to where we are today, which is really humming along. And the story about the Recovery Act has never been that it wasn't implemented effectively. That continues to be a non-news story, which we believe is an important success point. So 3 years from now, I hope the narrative is that Recovery Act and the first step that we took together as a management unit is really how it continued to play out over the course of the administration in terms of us bottling what we found successful in the Recovery Act in terms of working together, accountability, focus, relentless focus after some of the top priorities of implementation, and that in each of our areas we're seeing similar stories.
Well, thank you very much. I think this brings us to a close. Please join me in thanking these folks for a terrific discussion.